Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Appeal. Pope Benedict has urged an end to the violence in several Asian countries sparked by a plan to burn the Koran in the US, saying respect for religious freedom must prevail over hatred and violence. Papal Visit Preview. Our correspondent covering the papal visit to Britain paints a picture of the local atmosphere on the eve of Pope Benedict's arrival. And we also give you a preview of the main events during the four-day papal visit. And Spotlight on Scotland. The Pope begins his UK visit in Scotland, and we talk to Archbishop Mario Conti of Glasgow about the expectations among the local population on this first leg of the papal trip. Benedict has appealed for an end to the violence in several Asian countries sparked by a plan to burn the Koran in the US, saying respect for religious freedom must prevail over hatred and violence. His appeal came at the end of his Wednesday general audience. Emma McCarthy tells us more.
Pope Benedict XVI dedicated his last general audience before his departure for the United Kingdom to an appeal for respect for religious freedom and reconciliation in South Asia.
Comincio con un breve appello.
Speaking to a packed Paul VI audience hall, the Pope said, "I'm following with concern the events that occurred recently in various regions of South Asia, especially India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. I pray for the victims and call for respect for religious freedom and the logic of reconciliation and peace prevail over hatred and violence." Earlier in his catechesis, the Holy Father continued his series of lessons on the great women figures of the Church in the Middle Ages, this week illustrating the life and legacy of St. Clare of Assisi.
Born to a family of means, Clare chose to embrace a life of radical poverty, chastity, and trust in God's providence. As if by Francis, she consecrated herself completely to Christ, and together with her companions embraced a common life in the Church of San Damiano in Assisi.
Pope Benedict went on to say that the spiritual friendship between Clare and Francis reminds us of how the great saints have found in such friendships a powerful impetus to greater love of Christ and renewed strength in the pursuit of the way of perfection.
Clare's rules, the first written by a woman, sought to preserve and foster the Franciscan charism in the growing number of women's communities, which follows the example of Francis and her own. Her spirituality, nourished by the Eucharist, was based on the loving contemplation of Christ as the source and perfection of every virtue. St. Clare shows us the value of consecrated virginity as an image of the Church's love for her divine spouse and the decisive role played by courageous and faith-filled women to the Church's renewal in every age.
Finally, the Pope greeted English language pilgrims present in the Paul VI Hall.
Especially the pilgrim groups from England, Scotland, Sweden, the United Arab Emirates, Australia, and the United States of America, I invoke God's abundant blessings.
I'm Emma McCarthy.
Pope Benedict begins his much-anticipated four-day apostolic visit to Britain on Thursday, the first by a pope to the nation in nearly 30 years. It's a visit that takes him first to Scotland and then London, before concluding on Sunday in the English city of Birmingham, where he will beatify the 19th century theologian Cardinal Newman. One of our correspondents covering the papal visit is Philippa Hitchin, and she reports on the local atmosphere in Scotland on the eve of Pope Benedict's arrival there.
Just over 16 centuries ago, around the year 397 AD, a missionary bishop travelled from Rome to the remote windswept shores of Scotland to strengthen local people in their Christian faith, first inherited from the Romans. The bishop's name was Ninian, and though little is known about his life or his mission there, his legacy as the evangeliser of southern Scotland is celebrated each year on September the 16th. And now, on St. Ninian's Day 2010, another bishop is coming from Rome to strengthen the Catholic community in the faith and to stress the vital role that religion can play even in the most secular context that is the United Kingdom today. Over the past year, the government, churches, schools and ordinary Catholics here, led by Cardinal Keith Patrick O'Brien, have been working closely together, planning, quote, a grand Scottish spectacle to welcome Pope Benedict to this country, while at the same time raising funds for charities, including two local cancer hospices and a feeding project for children in developing countries. The Duke of Edinburgh, Prince Philip, may be meeting the Pope on his arrival at Edinburgh Airport, and Queen Elizabeth may be receiving him at her Holyrood House Palace for the first formal event of this visit. But it's the St. Ninian's Day parade through the central Prince's Street that will provide the most vivid experience of Scotland's history and traditions. Over 1,000 pipers and hundreds of schoolchildren will lead the parade, clad in their colourful tartan dress. And as you may have heard, a new St. Ninian's Day tartan design has been created especially for this occasion. Taking part in the parade will also be dozens of characters in costumes, charting the tumultuous history of Christianity in Scotland, including St. Columba, St. Margaret, Mary Queen of Scots, John Knox, and from more recent times, the Olympic runner Eric Liddell, poet and writer George Mackay Brown, and novelist Muriel Spark. From the Scottish capital, famed for its international festivals and listed amongst the UNESCO World Heritage Sites, the Pope then travels across to Glasgow, the working-class heartland of Catholicism, where tens of thousands of Irish immigrants fled with their families in past centuries to escape famine and hardship back home. This week, thousands more Irish Catholics are making the journey over to Glasgow to take part in the Mass that Pope Benedict will celebrate in Bella Houston Park before flying down to London on Thursday evening. The Pope may only be spending about 10 hours on Scottish soil, but the people north of the border here from all different churches and backgrounds are determined that this will be one visit he'll never forget. Awaiting Pope Benedict in the United Kingdom, I'm Philippa Hitchin.
Before she left for the UK, Philippa sat down with me to provide a preview of the main events on Pope Benedict's busy agenda during his four-day tour. She began by telling us about the Pope's first official engagement, a meeting with Queen Elizabeth at her official Scottish residence.
This meeting will take place in Holyrood Palace, which is the Queen's residence there in Scotland. And the reason that the Pope will be meeting her there instead of Buckingham Palace is simply that the Queen and her family spend most of the summer, July, August, September, up in Scotland at Balmoral. And therefore, as a kind of courtesy, if you like, to the Queen, instead of obliging her to come down to London, he's going to go into Edinburgh, first of all, as you say, and meet her there at Holyrood House. It will be a very important meeting because they will be discussing questions of the role of religion in British society today. As you know, the Queen is the head of the Church of England, together with, of course, Archbishop Rowan Williams, who is the spiritual leader of the whole Anglican Communion. And therefore, it'll be very much, I would imagine, the discussions focused on the place of religion in society, but also on world affairs, the Commonwealth.
After his stop in Edinburgh, the capital, then he moves to the city of Glasgow further west. Now, this is a city where one third of the population is Catholic, so one of the most Catholic cities in Britain, I imagine. There he's going to celebrate an open air mass. What kind of message do you think we're going to hear here, and what kind of turnout can we expect?
Yes, Glasgow, of course, as you rightly say, is the heartland of the Catholic Church in Scotland for a very specific reason, and that is that many of the migrants that came over from Ireland went to the city of Glasgow there on the west and down the whole of the west coast of Scotland, in fact. So, yes, there will be people from right across Scotland, but I understand there may also be plenty of people coming over from Ireland as well, and certainly people coming from across the border in England, throughout the north of England. People who can't make it down to London will go to Glasgow because it is one of the three events in which the public can come and be with the Pope in person. One is that Mass in Glasgow, secondly is the prayer vigil in Hyde Park, and thirdly is the beatification of Cardinal Newman in Birmingham. So, if you like, the northern part of Britain will be represented there at the Mass in Glasgow. And it'll be significant again because that was the same park, Bella Houston, the very same park where Pope John Paul II held a huge outdoor Mass for the faithful in 1982. And Pope Benedict will be celebrating just a few yards away from the very same place where Pope John Paul stood. There is now, I understand, a plaque there marking that 1982 Mass. And it's very much alive in the memory of people who were around at that time. They remember it very much as one of the highlights of that Scottish visit back in the 1980s.
OK, moving on to his second leg. He's going to be in London. And he begins that with his first engagement is at St Mary's University in Twickenham in southwest London. Now, Britain has very few Catholic universities. What is its claim to fame? What is particularly important about this university and why has he chosen to go there?
St Mary's is indeed very proud of being one of the leading Catholic universities in the country, if you like. Its history goes back quite a long way. It was originally just a teacher training college. Catholic education, as you know, has always been an important focus of the church since the restoration of the hierarchy. They were more, if you like, focused on education, educating people, than they were on actually building churches. So it's been very much a centre of learning and of training other people to go and work in Catholic schools. Now it has the status of a university. It has an Olympic training centre there. Many of the people who will be competing, I understand, in the 2012 Olympics will be training there at St Mary's. The event with the Pope is divided into three parts. The Pope arrives and meets with religious men and women, people from religious congregations in the chapel for a quiet moment of prayer, very much in contrast to the next, if you like, centrepiece of the event, which is a meeting outside in this sports, state-of-the-art sports stadium with over 4,000 school children who've come from right across the country. It's being called the Big Assembly. It's being billed as the kind of assembly that school children in Britain have every morning when they go to school.
Quite a noisy affair, I imagine.
I'm sure it'll be very lively. They'll be singing. It's focused around the theme from St John's Gospel, I have come that you may have life and have it to the full. The third part of the programme there at St Mary's is, again, a quieter meeting, but very significant, in one of the rooms inside the college, and that is with interfaith leaders, representatives of the main, I think it's nine faith groups in Britain today, including, of course, the very significant Jewish community. The chief rabbi, Lord Jonathan Sacks, will be addressing the Pope, as will a member of the Muslim community in Britain, but there will also be representatives of the many other faith groups, Buddhists, Hindus, and so on. So it'll be an important meeting and interesting to hear what the Pope has to say about interfaith relations in Britain today.
Moving on to Friday evening, the Pope then has what Archbishop Nichols has called three quite remarkable events, very much photo opportunities, aren't they? The first, of course, is the visit and the meeting with the Archbishop of Canterbury, the head of the Anglican Communion. Tell us a bit about that, Philippa.
That'll be a meeting in Lambeth Palace, the Archbishop of Canterbury's residence, just a few miles down from Westminster. And it's significant because Archbishop Rowan, as you know, has been here to the Vatican on a number of occasions, met with Pope Benedict here. But this will be the first time the Pope is being received, if you like, by Archbishop Rowan in his residence there at Lambeth. And of course, they'll be discussing the problems, but also the progress that's been made in recent years in relations between the Anglican and Catholic churches. And again, they will be discussing the role of faith in the society, in the secular society in Britain today. So that'll be the first meeting, as you say. The Pope then goes on to Westminster Hall.
Well, he's got a keynote speech, which I think is going to be very keenly awaited, as you mentioned before, talking to Britain's
political and cultural leaders,
movers,
right?
And shakers,
the
very
movers
much.
And shakers, yes.
Absolutely. And it is in Westminster Hall, which is particularly significant as the place where Sir Thomas More, St. Thomas More, made his impassioned speech about being the king's servant but God's servant first. It's all about that difficult relationship between church and state, between allegiance to a nation but allegiance to one's faith, about the role of conscience and public life. So, yes, it will be one of the key speeches, I think, keenly watched by all the commentators, all the observers, and the Westminster Hall there will be packed with all the influential politicians, policymakers, and religious leaders in Britain. So that'll be the second event on the Friday. And from there, then, he moves on to Westminster Abbey, of course, just next door to Parliament, the place where, if you like, church and state really come together, where the monarchs, the British monarchs, have been crowned over the centuries since 1066. And there, the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Pope will pray together at the shrine of Edward the Confessor, of course, honoured by both the Anglican and the Catholic churches. And again, it'll be a powerful moment of common witness, the leaders of these two great faiths making a very public statement about their desire to work together for the good of British society.
Saturday has also been spent by the Pope in London, and after a series of private meetings with the Prime Minister and other political leaders, his main event that morning is a Mass being celebrated in Westminster Cathedral. Tell us a bit about, first of all, the cathedral itself and what is likely to be, shall we say, the theme of this Mass?
Westminster Cathedral is the icon, if you like, of the Catholic community in Britain today. It's quite an extraordinary looking building, sort of early Byzantine style, and it's got some interesting works of art inside it. And I understand there'll be lots of young people outside there with big screens watching while the Pope celebrates Mass inside the cathedral. This will be his first, if you like, real meeting with the Catholic community there in England. Archbishop Vincent Nicholls, as the Archbishop of Westminster, will be on hand there to celebrate with the Pope. And afterwards, he will come outside and he will address these young people gathered in the square, very much with a message, I'm sure, encouraging them and their role as the new generation, if you like, of Catholics in Britain today. So again, it'll be an interesting one, and it'll be very significant for the Catholic community there, not just in London, but throughout England. However, as you know, the Bishops' Conference is not just the Bishops' Conference of England, it's the Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. And although Pope Benedict won't actually be travelling to Wales on this occasion, Pope John Paul did when he went in 1982, but as this is just a four-day visit, in order to, if you like, recognise the Catholic Church in Wales at the end of that Mass in Westminster Cathedral, the Pope will be blessing a new mosaic dedicated to St. David, the patron saint of Wales, and he will no doubt have words to say about the Catholic community there as well. So it'll be very inclusive, if you like, of Catholics throughout England and Wales.
And then his final event on Saturday is this prayer vigil for the beatification of Cardinal John Henry Newman that's been held in London's Hyde Park. I imagine there's going to be quite a big turnout for this. Can you fill us in?
This is the second opportunity for the public, if you like, to be able to meet with Pope Benedict. And yes, they are expecting a huge turnout. In fact, I think it's been quite difficult to allocate tickets because so many people wanted to go. They've had to use lottery systems and so on. Many young people will be attending that. I know for sure there'll be a lot of musical parts to that. And it is, as you say, a vigil for the beatification of Cardinal Newman, which will take place the following day, Sunday, in Birmingham. And so there'll be a lot of reflection on Newman's life, on his legacy and his message to particularly young people today struggling to understand the demands of conscience and peer pressure. Of course, the difficulties that Newman suffered when he decided to leave the Church of England and to become a Catholic. I think a lot of that will be brought out in this prayer vigil in a very vivid and interesting way.
Right, moving on to Sunday, his final day, he leaves London and flies to Birmingham, where, as you just said, he's going to be celebrating this Mass for the beatification of Cardinal Newman, definitely one of the highlights of the visit. Tell us a little bit about this and what we're likely to hear and see and what it all means.
This is particularly interesting because, as you know, Pope Benedict, unlike his predecessor John Paul II, decided that beatifications, rather than taking place always here in the Vatican, should be carried out by the local church leaders in the local place where these saints, these blessed, are at home, if you like, the local church.
But he's broken his rules here.
Exactly. And apparently, when the organisers of the visit were talking about this trip, Pope Benedict said he wanted to go to the UK for the beatification. And his aides objected rather gently that, Your Holiness, the new rule is that beatifications take place with the local church leader in the local church, the local country. And apparently the Pope said, yes, that is the rule, but this is an extremely good exception to that rule. So it's very much he himself. Himself, as a great devotee of Newman, who wanted to go to Britain and who wanted to carry out this beatification celebration himself. And so, yes, it is very much one of the highlights, the reason, the raison d'etre for this visit.
I was speaking to my colleague Philippa Hitchin just before her departure to the UK to cover the papal visit there. Benedict's UK visit has been the subject of considerable debate in Britain and even hostility from some militant secular groups in the run-up to his arrival. Father Christopher Jameson is the former abbot of Worth Abbey in southern England, and he believes that there are now clear signs of a more welcoming tone as the Pope's arrival draws closer.
The Prime Minister, David Cameron, has today posted on the official No. 10 Downing Street website a message of welcome from the Prime Minister to His Holiness. And it's very striking that in that message, David Cameron emphasises the contribution that all faith communities make to the well-being of the United Kingdom. And in particular, he wants to hear what a faith community can contribute to the well-being of Britain. And he says that we won't all agree with what the Pope says, but we have a lot to learn. And I think the fact that the government is so positive about it is really, really important. And the reasons of state for the visit are starting to come through more strongly now. There's been so much negativity from small groups who disagree with the Catholic Church fundamentally that now what's coming through much more strongly is the sense that these are very significant historic days with a great deal for Britain to gain from them.
Do you think that message from the political leaders is filtering down, though, to the people in the pews, to people who may come and see the Pope?
I think the Catholic community has been dismayed by some of the hostility directed towards it by the militant secularist groups. But there's no question that in recent days that has been eclipsed by, for example, the Times of London saying in their editorial that the Pope's visit was important and significant and Britain should welcome it. And perhaps most interestingly, The Guardian, the traditional left-wing newspaper of Great Britain, also writing a leading article saying that the Pope was a welcome visitor to these shores. And I think that's the beginnings there. The leading articles in the top newspapers, the Prime Minister's word of welcome, the press conference and the activity by Lord Paton today, who's the Prime Minister's representative and the chief organiser for the government, all of these messages now are starting to get through not only to Catholics, but to ordinary British people.
That was Father Christopher Jameson, former abbot of Worth Abbey, speaking to Philippa Hitchin. As we heard earlier, the first leg of Pope Benedict's UK visit takes him to Scotland, where his main engagement is an open-air mass held in the western city of Glasgow. The Catholic Archbishop of Glasgow is Mario Conti, and in a recent interview, he spoke to Philippa Hitchin about the expectations ahead of the papal visit to Scotland.
What I have found particularly encouraging is the way in which the city itself, the city authorities, want the Pope to come. People of other faiths want the Pope to come. People will speak to me and say, I'm so glad the Pope is coming. It's what we need, we Christians, to have, you know, that focus on the great church leader, you know, at a time when the church is up against, all the churches are up against, an increasingly secularist society. Secularist in part, I suppose, and that's the hardest part. But in another way, maybe the hardest part pastorally is the growing sort of apathy or distancing of people from religious faith or religious belonging.
Do you think a visit like this can in some way galvanise people, can rekindle that spirit of faith in a way that perhaps Scotland hasn't seen for many years?
I think so. I think you're absolutely right in proposing the question to me like that. And that's what our expectation would be. And those of us who remember the visit of Pope John Paul II in 1982 can remember how the development then of ecumenical relations took a quantitative leap, you know, and really that visit galvanised the ecumenical movement. And I can imagine that the same thing will happen again in giving confidence to the churches. You know, they're working together to re-Christianise, to re-evangelise our society, to bring people to an intimate knowledge of Christ and not some sort of distant memory that somehow, well, you know, we're a Christian society, but of course we don't belong to any church now. Yes, we're religious, but not in that sort of way, you know. And how long can that be without the focus on the person of Christ and his grace?
What kind of message do you hope that the Pope can bring specifically to the city of Glasgow and the people there? It's really the heartland, isn't it, of the Catholic Church in this country?
Yes, that's a question I'd have to ponder a little bit. I mean, our expectations is that his coming will remind people of their Christian past. It's a time now when I think people will be quite content. It's, after all, the 450th anniversary of the Reform Parliament, 1560. Remind them that there was a division in society which changed the religious complexion of the country. And in the meantime, you know, the Catholic Church has grown enormously, largely through immigration, but not only. And one would hope that the Pope would be reminding us of the past, of the contribution that the Catholic Church had made historically to Scotland, which I think people are quite more prepared to hear today than they might have been in the past, in a more ecumenical climate. But also, I think, hopefully, to give us some sort of confidence or hope, vision for society. But the very fact that he will be the focus of so much attention and attention of the international press and, of course, the local press gives the church an opportunity, or the churches, to say something about themselves, about their history and about their mission.
The highlight will be an open-air mass, won't it? Yes. Tell us a little bit more about that, if you can.
Well, the city of Glasgow has offered us again, at the expense of the city, Bella Houston Park, where Pope John Paul II was received, and where the largest gathering of Christians in our history took place on that very lovely summer's day in 1982, memorable. And we're hoping that something of the same will occur again.
You were there, were you, in 1982 in the park?
I was, as a young bishop. That shows how old I am.
What do you remember most? What are your lasting impressions of that occasion?
Joy, the song of joy, the enthusiasm of the people. It was a feeling that at last the Catholic community could hold its head up. It was, we've come home. We're not in the periphery of this country. We're at its heart. We're part of its community.
That was the Archbishop of Glasgow, Mario Conti, speaking to Philippa Hitchin. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.